Before we get started, just a note for everyone, you might hear some noise in the background here. Our esteemed guest was coming to us from Fort Myers, Florida, in a condo where apparently some construction was going on. So our apologies, we've tried to mitigate it as much as possible, but I don't think we could mitigate all of it. So this is the nature of podcasting. Sometimes you have to deal with external environmental factors, and I don't think it's too bad. You'll still enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to the Good Faith Podcast. I'm Curtis Chang with David French. And if that greeting sounds a little different than what you've been used to, it's because it is. Normally, David is the one welcoming listeners, but this podcast is a transition podcast. David, the last couple of weeks, we've been a little coy, haven't we?
We have been, because we've been trying to figure out exactly what was going to happen next, and now we know. So yeah, we've got the bottom line is, the Good Faith Podcast continues, and it will continue, and you don't have to do anything for it to continue to come into your feed. Everything's going to seem totally the same, except Curtis is going to be hosting the podcast. So this is going to be Curtis Chang's Good Faith Podcast.
Well, I think the actual title is going to be Curtis Chang and Friends, and part of those friends is David French. So it's true. This is not so much a passing of the torch. It's more like a shifting of the torch. So like my hand kind of gets pole position on the torch because I will be the host, but David will be a regular guest, a regular recurrent guest, minimally once a month. Hopefully we're going to get him maybe sometimes more than that, but David will get to continue our conversation. But we're also going to include other friends. I mean, really, the heart of Good Faith is it is friends who love Jesus and are trying to help each other make sense of this world. I mean, actually, our podcast began, David, if you remember, because you were writing your Sunday newsletters and I was, you know, you were asking me for my theological thoughts and we were just exchanging long marathon texts. And we just realized, yep. You know, maybe we should just talk this out and turn on record and we've got a podcast. So that's the spirit of the Good Faith Podcast, and it's going to continue. I do want to acknowledge, you know, there is some sense of loss, as with all transitions, there's a loss. For those of you listeners who really have enjoyed hearing David and I talk, you'll be getting somewhat less of that. It won't go away. David's still going to be here monthly, but you'll be getting some less of that. So there is a loss there that I do want to acknowledge, but I think the nature of transitions, and we're going to talk about this today, the nature of transitions is that you have to go through some loss to get some new gain. And the new gain that I believe is for all of you listeners is you're going to hear even more voices that represent that underlying spirit of good faith. You're going to hear more voices of me talking to friends who love Jesus. And together, we're going to try to make sense of the world. So to give you two examples of friends that are going to be coming on, one is Nancy French, who is more than a friend to David, his wife. And Nancy is going to be coming on to tell stories. If listeners have known how much we have in the past talked about the power of stories, and I'll bet for many listeners, you know, what you remember of past episodes is more than some scintillating, brilliant point, you know, David and I made. It's probably some story that we've told. And we've talked about the power of stories. So Nancy will be coming on as storyteller because I think stories are so crucial to how we make sense of the world. And Nancy is one of the funniest, best, smartest storytellers I know. So we're going to have her come on doing that. Another regular recurring guest who has agreed to come on repeatedly is our common friend, Andy Crouch, who is especially, I'm really eager to bring on Andy because I think making sense of our world going forward involves making sense of technology. And there's no friend I have that I turn to more regularly and more eagerly than Andy Crouch to make sense of technology and culture. And so he'll be coming on to do that. And maybe if David has his way, he'll also be sharing more stories of life in a Christian commune with me.
I'm still getting over, Curtis, I'm still having trouble getting over the fact that you guys not only were roommates, which is totally great and awesome and amazing, but what was it? You couldn't spend $10 without each other's consent?
Without telling each other what we were going to spend that $10 on. So it was like a monastic commitment to having all things in common. So anyway,
I've got too much of that don't tread on me libertarian spirit to agree to such terms.
Yes, David calls that our Christian commune, that with a slight communist sort of tint to it. But yeah, so we're gonna, and in addition, we're going to bring on other friends. And that's why in this transition episode, we are actually going to start that by bringing on a good friend of ours, Michael Lindsay. Michael Lindsay is the president of Taylor University. He was before that the president of Gordon College. And before that was an award-winning sociologist. But above all that, he's our pal. He's our friend. So Michael, welcome to Good Faith.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Okay, let me ask him something real fast here, because you said award-winning sociologist. Have you followed the battles online over whether sociology is a worthwhile pursuit for Christians or it should be all theology?
Yeah, I am familiar with some of those conversations, yeah.
Any thoughts as to, for those listeners who, because believe it or not, this has become a thing that a sociologist is, if you're applying sociology to cultural issues, then you're necessarily not applying theology. And theology is our path forward, not sociology. So just give it a whirl.
All truth is God's truth. And I think that there's amazing insights that disciplines other than theology can provide to helping understand the human condition and how we ought to respond. I oftentimes say that social science is really good at revealing the depravity of humanity. So it shows a lot of the problems and our need for divine intervention. But I'm really grateful that there are committed Christ followers who are working in all the different academic disciplines. And I'm grateful for the training I got in sociology. I use it every single day in my work of leading a Christian college and university.
Well, one of the things that Michael studied in his career as a sociologist before he became college president at two leading Christian colleges was the study of leaders. And Michael, one of the things I love about Michael and why I with some regularity go to him for advice as a friend is because he himself is a leader, obviously, as a president of a institution of higher education. But he's also studied leaders extensively. He had one of the largest studies of public leaders, tracing their career. He's produced multiple books out of that, Faith in the Halls of Power, A View from the Top. And his most recent book is the reason why I wanted to bring him onto this transition episode of Good Faith. His book was called Hinge Moments, Making the Most of Life's Transitions. And actually, when I was thinking about this transition that I needed to make around Good Faith, I actually called Michael up for advice on this because he's both studied this subject and also himself has lived out some significant transitions. So, Michael, tell us why did you write this book? What's the origin of this book? Why did you zero in on transitions and especially looking at transitions through the lives of leaders that you were studying?
It started because I was looking for a gift for high school and college graduates, a book that I could give to them as they were thinking about change in their life. I was super unsatisfied with what I found. And so I got to thinking, well, maybe I could write a book that would sort of speak to them. So I'd spent 10 years of my life interviewing, everybody from Jimmy Carter and George Bush to Fortune 100 CEOs to the presidents of Harvard, Stanford, Princeton. So a wide array of leaders. And I went back and reread every one of those transcripts and all of my notes. So it took a long, long time and made a master list of advice or recommendations or stories of people who had navigated that well. And as I read it, it started like speaking to my own life. And I was approaching 50 and thinking, gosh, you know, and maybe am I supposed to have this transition? And the idea of the concept of a hinge moment really occurred because hinges are these engineering marvels. They're a little piece of metal that you attach to a slab of wood that keeps a door that's currently closed. It keeps it closed. If it's open, it keeps it open, but it also can allow an open door to close and a closed door to open. It's just amazing. And so I begin to think, you know, oftentimes God brings events, circumstances into our lives, some of our choosing, some not of our choosing. And yet it can be moments where pathways are opened or pathways are closed, and it becomes important, significant moments that happen in our life. So I was really interested in how do we make the most of those transitions, some that we choose, some that are chosen for us. And in the process of writing the book, which I did most of the writing during the pandemic, I just realized it had a wider readership than high school or college graduates. And it's been fun to see friends who benefited from some of the insights, and hopefully it's a blessing to lots of people.
Have you crossed 50 yet?
I have. Yep, I'm 51.
I just hit my birthday a couple of days ago, so I'm in 54. This is the only, like, Curtis, I think this might be one of the few purely Gen X podcasts out there.
That's right.
And you and me and basically every guest is right in that sweet spot.
Because this is a podcast about friends and we're all of this same generation. So I'm hoping that people older and younger are still benefiting from it, but it's true. There's a generational tilt to this.
We all went through that key hinge moment of American history, which is the transition from hair bands to grunge rock. So do you touch on that in the book at all?
I don't. I leave that for you, David. Okay. I look forward to seeing your next column about it.
Well, you talked about how you've spoken to a lot of high level leaders, people who have been at the absolute pinnacle of government, of corporate life, of academic life. How is their experience going to be relevant to a broader audience and to the kinds of transitions that we all go through that are not so much under the same kind of microscope, say, that those folks endure?
Well, just as any kid who wants to learn how to play basketball better can watch Michael Jordan and get inspiration and maybe some practical advice, so also I think if you look to people who have navigated change and transition well, and many leaders have done that well, and because their lives are more public, we know more about them, we know more of the context, we can not just study their perspective, but other people's perspective, which gives a fuller picture. All of that, I think, really helps us to get some good practical advice. And so along the way, I've tried to tell the stories in hinge moments. I tell the stories about 24 people who I thought navigated change and transition. Most of them did it well. Some didn't do it well. But from all of them, we can learn and hopefully apply it in our own life.
Yeah, I think we're all going through transitions all the time. Our kid is leaving home. It's a transition for your life as a parent. You're taking on a new job. So you're transitioning in terms of your vocational life. In terms of our relationship to our parents, like I'm struck, since we're talking about generations, how much my peer group is going through a transition in their life as sons and daughters, that they are taking on a transition to a role of caretaker. They're in some ways parenting their parents after a lifetime of the other way around. So our lives seem to be full of constant transitions. You say this in your book, that the one constant thing in life is change. So we're constantly navigating transitions of all sorts. Your book has a lot of insights and an overarching framework that I encourage people to get the book, to get the multitude of insights. But I wanted to ask you, Michael, was there any insight that felt like, this is a little surprising, or this is the one that people tend to neglect when they're going through a transition?
Well, one of the things, the book walks you through what I concluded are seven phases of transition. And that process was instructive in my own journey because I made a transition in the midst of writing this book. But I think that one of the things I did not expect is that oftentimes God will use circumstances and opportunities to both unsettle our current environment. So we begin to sort of become restless or frustrated. Sometimes it comes across in the form of anger or fear, but you can just tell in your soul something, you're not as settled as you once were. And so you begin feeling this unsettling. And that's very unnerving, right? Because you're like, what's going on? And why am I feeling this? But actually, if you can pay attention to that restlessness, I really do believe the Holy Spirit can use those moments to begin sort of prompting you to do something new or different. Very small example. I was a faculty member at Rice. I was doing very well in my field and feeling, you know, really like I had sort of mastered my job. But after a while, I was restless and I began sort of exploring possibilities. I went and took a class over at the business school at Rice, thinking that I might try and pursue a academic appointment there just as a joint appointment to do something a little bit different. Actually, I was hungry for the opportunity to lead. I just didn't have the words to name it. And I didn't have the framework to think. I didn't see where would I go? What would I do? So I just began exploring things. I think that as you begin feeling that restlessness and you start to explore, you just have to be super attentive, because oftentimes I find that God uses that to prepare us for what comes next.
So I'm really intrigued because of the notion that there are hinge moments that have, there are positive stories from hinge moments and there are negative stories from hinge moments. And I'm always interested in negative stories, because in many ways I learn from them more than I learn from the positive stories. I'll give you a great example. My friend Phil Vischer wrote a book based on his years building VeggieTales. And it's a book about disasters, like one disastrous decision after another. And I'd never in my life read a business book by a business leader that's all about all of the mistakes that he made. I mean, he was extremely ambitious and had big, big, big plans for what Big Idea Productions, I believe that's what VeggieTales was called, was going to be. And it's just a really open, honest, transparent look at how you can reach too far. Really fascinating. And I learned a lot from it. So what are some of the negative lessons, some of the negative stories about hinge moments that impacted you in your research?
Well, I did interview Phil, and it's an amazing story where the night of the red carpet gala for their biggest motion picture release of Jonah, the next day they're delivering pink slips to a lot of their employees. So that was quite compelling. But probably the standout example of not navigating transition well was Hank Greenberg. So Greenberg had served as the CEO of AIG, massive financial services firm, insurance. And many people believe AIG was the beginning of the economic freefall we experienced 2007-2008. And in the end, he was reprimanded and lost his job. And at the time I was interviewing him, he had left AIG, but he was trying to rebuild a new business. And he was like 87 years old. And I said to him, you know, you've got a family, grandkids, philanthropic interests. Aren't there other things that you want to leave as part of your legacy, not just, you know, rebuilding another business that could rival AIG? And he said, there is nothing else. Like, he could not conceive that there would be anything meaningful in his life aside from being a business success. And I think oftentimes hinge moments have a way of breaking our patterns and some of our ways of thinking. And failure, disappointment, loss can be a wake-up call to say, maybe I need to refocus. Maybe I need to be more engaged with my wife. I need to be a better dad. Or maybe I need to think about how my values that I believe are not actually coming across in how people experience me. You've got to use those hinge moments to learn from it. And he was a great example of somebody who did not learn a thing. And I think it really, he's kind of the classic example that I hold up to my students of don't be like this.
Wow, that's a great story. Michael, I'm actually really intrigued about this idea of hinge moments being connected to each other, that we go through our hinge moments and it's not just that we're navigating our own lives, but in some way we're interconnected, like our hinges are connected to each other's hinges, so that when one person is navigating, hopefully faithfully and not negatively the way you just gave an example, but faithfully, that it opens up some spiritual sacred space almost for somebody else to have their hinge moment. And I was thinking about this actually in reflecting about our current hinge moment at Good Faith with this podcast, because, you know, what triggers this move for us as Good Faith is David has a hinge moment. David is about to be, you know, walk through the door of New York Times, which is a doorway into kind of his next stage as a public thought leader, commentator. And it's fantastic. It's an important hinge moment for him. But what it does as he navigates it faithfully and trying to, you know, discern what he ought to do, is it opens up this funny space for me, because I got into the Good Faith podcast really, like I said, was really just out of my friendship with David. I mean, it was those text exchanges that was the origins of it. And I really felt called to the Good Faith podcast really to support David, because I really believe, and I don't normally say this to David, but I'll say it now, I really believe David's voice is really important to the church and to the wider society. So David, don't let that go to your head. But it's really one of the most important voices, I think. And I felt like I was honored to be his theological wingman. And so my sense of my own calling was be a good friend to David, support his voice. And so when he told me that he could no longer be the host of the Good Faith podcast, my immediate assumption was, oh, I guess that's the end of the Good Faith podcast, because, you know, it was about supporting David's voice. And what it opened for me, this David taking his hinge moment, what it opened for me was this moment of like, no, I felt like God was saying to me, like, wait a minute, no, you have a calling that's not disconnected from David, but is not completely dependent on David. Because and this came to me when I was imagining David and I having this episode and announcing to our listeners, well, we're sorry, but the Good Faith podcast is ending. And I just felt like I could not bring myself to have that episode happen, because we get so many emails and messages of people saying, hey, your podcast is a help to us. It's keeping me sane. It's helping me retain some sense of hope to be a Christian in the world. And I thought, you know, it's not like we have the answers to that, but we are clearly providing something of a gathering place where they can be here to friends, make sense of this confusing, difficult time in the world that we're in. And I just thought, no way, I'm called to that. And this last few weeks, last month, has been for me like a hinge moment to say, I have a calling in this that's still related, still connected, where David and I are still going to do this together. But in some ways, it's stepping forward, stepping up in a different way than just being David's wingman. And so I wanted to ask you, does that fit like a pattern you've seen, that when that part of a hinge moment is you're, as you navigate that, hopefully faithfully, you're creating space for others to step into their hinge moment?
It absolutely occurs. There's cascading hinge moments. So David has a hinge moment, then that affects Curtis's hinge moment, then that affects Nancy and Andy's hinge moment. So there's one person's actions can have a cascading effect. And then there's also concatenating hinge moments. So different things, but you pay more attention when you're going through a transition. You pay more attention to your friends or other people in your network who are also going through it. So you're more attentive to people who are moving when you yourself are moving. You're more attentive to people getting married when you're getting married. So how those life stage things affect, then they sort of help you to see the world in a different way. They bring you lenses or perspectives. So we found many examples of those. And the nice thing about it is that oftentimes those cascading hinge moments then also have created a bond for friendship and connection. It's how spouses can get closer to one another. Families can get closer to one another. It also means you have to be very attentive, because it can be moments in those hinge moments can be unsettling, that creates disruption and fractures in relationships. So oftentimes in the book, I talk about, you get to this liminal space, the space between spaces, where you've sort of pulled away from your last chapter, but you've not yet settled into your next chapter. And when you're in that in-between space, you actually don't have the same network of support and encouragement that you used to have, or that you will have, because you don't have your old network and you don't yet have your new network. And so longtime friends and family members become really key people to speak into your life, to help you make sense and to come alongside you. And the reason those matter so much is because when you're going between seasons, when you're opening up a new office, or you're moving to a new location, or you're adopting a kid, man, the change you're facing is significant. It changes all your routines, change your habits, and you're feeling anxious and nervous and excited, but worried. And so all of your emotion work is multiplied, and you need some people to come alongside you and help you with that emotion work. And so that's why we rely upon those close relationships. And it's, in essence, you're withdrawing the relational capital you've been depositing in the more settled time to help you in the unsettled times.
There's a concept that called scouting out the land in terms of, you know, paying attention to the kind of institution you're about to enter. So I'm about to enter a new institution. At the times. Now, I'm in Tennessee. I have a little bit harder time sort of really fully scouting out the land because I'm not going to be diving into the New York office. I'm going to try to, you know, get as much FaceTime as I can, as soon as I can. But what does this mean? What does scouting out the land mean in a Hinge moment? Because that's a fascinating term, and one that, you know, it resonates with common sense, but what are the nuances of this? What does this mean?
It's really about you getting to meet people and to make connections. It's a chance to see the space, to kind of explore, like you're the newcomer and you're trying to meet all the key players. And the benefit is that when you're new, you can ask all the questions that a month later you won't be able to ask because you're assumed to already know them. So you can ask things that are awkward and uncomfortable and that try to understand idiosyncrasies. A small example, you have a coworker that walks with a limp. If you don't ask them about the limp the first week or so that you notice it, after a while, you can't ask them because it's too weird to ask after a while. So scouting out the land is really about taking advantage of the moment and to better understand it.
Michael, on this theme of entering a new institution, you actually have this phrase when you talk about scouting out the land, this idea of a hidden curriculum of a place, that every institution has some norms, has some rules that are obvious and known to everybody. But sometimes the most important thing to pay attention to when you are making a transition is figuring out what you call the hidden curriculum of a new place. Explain more what you mean by that and why that's important.
Every place where we live, work, and study have a set of norms and expectations. And so sometimes those are made explicit, but oftentimes you just pick them up. So you learn pretty quickly. Some workplaces have salty languages that you can use, and others that's out of bounds. And most people will change their behavior based upon what those norms and expectations are. So you've got to learn it and get a little bit of a sense of what are the expectations you've got as you go to a new school, a new community, a new workplace environment. But the best thing about the hidden curriculum is that when you're new, you have the opportunity to ask the kinds of questions that make the hidden curriculum explicit and known. So you can just ask people, hey, what do people do for lunch? Do you sit at your desk? Do you go out with friends? Is there a norm that we go eat together? You begin to ask those kinds of questions. And I oftentimes am giving advice to college students about how do they learn the hidden curriculum of the workplace where they join. So asking questions of your manager, you know, how often do you want to hear from me? Do you hope to hear from me every day, once a week? Or do we see each other, you know, quarterly? What are the kind of norms and expectations? And as you learn the hidden curriculum and ask about it, it makes it a whole lot easier for you to become sort of a full-fledged member of the community. And part of the reason I wrote Hinge Moments was to help people master the hidden curriculum so they can become trusted and valuable early on in their tenure.
Let's move on from sort of the personal Hinge moment to institutional Hinge moments. And I'm very interested in what's happening at Christian colleges and universities. And There are a lot of challenges that are being faced right now. There are challenges relating to demographics. There are also challenges related to culture and politics. There are a lot of cross-current pressures on presidents of Christian universities, colleges and universities right now. I've talked to Christian college presidents who are caught between faculty and alumni. I have talked to Christian college presidents who suddenly found themselves in the epicenter of the culture wars unwillingly. I've talked to students who feel caught in the middle or maybe trying to drive the institution one way or the other. And it's all taking place against the backdrop of real demographic change in the United States. So where is the Christian college and university community in this, in, you know, where are their hinge moments right now? What are you seeing as sort of the primary hinge moments that Christian colleges are facing?
There are 2 million fewer college students today in institutions of higher learning in the U.S. than there were 5 years ago. And that trend is going to continue. The college-bound population in the U.S. is going to decrease even further because in the depths of the financial recession of 2008, families were not having as many kids. And so once we get to 2026, the year that that cohort turns 18, there'll be far fewer students going to colleges and universities. So that's creating enrollment and financial hinge moments for institutions of higher learning. But you're right, David, there are cultural and even theological differences and challenges that we're facing in the church. And I apologize for the noise, but it's part of the challenge and opportunity, I think, that we have in Christian higher education. And when I get a chance to work with students, I'm actually encouraged by seeing how they're responding to the current environment. And I also think that there's a great opportunity for faithful Christian institutions who can lead really well.
Michael, let's talk about this idea that institutions have hinge moments, because a big theme in the Good Faith podcast is the importance of institutions, that institutions are beings that really have a life, a spiritual life even of their own, that we need to attend to. And so you're talking a little bit about the particular challenges facing the institution of Christian colleges. A lot of our listeners are part of institutions that also are going through their own particular hinge moments at work, in their industry, in their church, in their nonprofit that they're leading. Our society is just sort of in a moment of disruption and challenge that I just think almost every type of institution feels like they're navigating some hinge moment. So what I want to ask then is, okay, so for a Christian who believes that they have been called to that particular institution that's going through some hinge moment, how does that Christian play a faithful role? Like, how does a Christian discern, well, if this institution is going through a hinge moment, how do I discern God's calling for me as a member of this institution? Do you have some advice for some framework, some ways to think about that question for an individual within an institution?
Well, my hunch is that most institutional leaders are not upset about hinge moments where really great things are happening, where, you know, the revenues are growing dramatically and the reputation is rising. So it's not those kind of hinge moments, but probably it's hinge moments of challenge, whether it's reputational challenge or financial issues or competition that you're feeling the intensity around. And there, I think the spiritual practices of the leader make a real difference. And so there's some practical things that I talk about in the book, the value of contemplative prayer, the importance of having silence, solitude, and Sabbath as regular practices in your own sort of journey. I think it's also important. I'm a real big fan of Ruth Haley Barton's work on Pursuing God's Will Together. It's a wonderful book that gives practical advice of how Christian leaders can help their institutions navigate those hinge moments with integrity and to sort of get to a place of mutual discernment. The Quakers have this idea that, you know, all of our hearts have to be at rest if we're going to do something. And you don't have to take a Quaker sensibility to understand the importance of bringing people along. And so oftentimes the leader's role is to help people to make sense of the change, because people fear change because fundamentally they think it's about loss. What am I losing? And so you've got to help them with the emotion management of that. But then also, I think it's about helping them to see the possibility of a new future reality. In the book, I talk about how you have to sort of navigate the roller coaster of change. And typically the leader is like the person riding in the front car of that roller coaster. So the leader is the person who reaches the pinnacle of a hill before everybody else does. While people are still further back climbing up the hill, the leader is already there. But it also means the leader gets on the downward side of that hill at the very moment when some of the folks in the organization are still climbing. They may be at the top. And so I think the tough thing about leading is that you have to not only manage your own emotions, but also the emotions of other people who are at different phases of transition, and they're coming to grips with it in different ways. So spiritual practices, I think, really make a difference. Second thing I'd say is mutual support. So finding a peer network of people who are similarly situated. What I'm involved, for example, in a small group of Christian college presidents of universities, and we get together regularly, and oftentimes we commiserate. Oftentimes we're talking about, the challenges, but we also celebrate one another's accomplishments. And I guess sort of hold each other's arms up when we need that kind of support in the moment. And each of us have faced that at different points in time. So mutual support, I think, is a second strategy that you can pursue. Third and finally, I think that the leader has to have a regular rhythm of immersion in the community, being really involved, so people experience the leader. So it's that incarnational kind of leadership. And then I also think you have to, with regularity, Ron Heifetz has this metaphor of getting to the balcony where you're watching the dance floor below, but you're not actually dancing. You've got to have a regular rhythm where you're taking stock and being able to sort of make sense of the world. So I interviewed George Shultz, who was Secretary of State in the Reagan administration, and he's a very interesting man. And he was really the primary advisor to President Reagan who pushed President Reagan for direct engagement with Gorbachev to try and see if they could bring about real change and maybe end the Cold War. And, there's lots of people who played a role, a woman named Roz Ridgway, who was the head of, Assistant Secretary for European Affairs. She played a key role. But George Shultz did it. And every Tuesday and Thursday for 90 minutes, he sat in his office where no one but the president or his wife could interrupt him. And he used those 90 minutes to say, what's the big, game we're playing here to try and change the dynamic? And that regular rhythm of solitude and silence allowed him to keep focused on the big issue. And I do think that leaders have to build those kind of habits and practices in their leadership to help their institutions navigate hinge moments.
Michael, those are a great set of advice for folks who are leaders, like at the top of the organization and responsible for the organization. I'm wondering about advice and encouragement for people who are members of an organization going through a transition, who are followers. And something you said made me really think about this, that usually a transition moment that provides challenge, most organizations are feeling that because it's a negative transition. There's something hard that's happening. And I have found that oftentimes is like the signal for many members of the organization to leave. And sometimes that's a good thing to do, that's a right, faithful discernment that, okay, this is now the time for me to leave. But I've discerned quite often, it's just like they just want to flee a sinking ship, or they want to get out of a situation that seems like it's going bad. And if everybody does that, that actually furthers the difficulties of an institution. And you need glue people. You need people who have a sense of calling to the institution through a difficult transition, not as a opportunity for them to also jump ship. And again, I don't mean to say that leaving an organization is always a bad thing. I mean, like you talked about in your own life, in your own book, sometimes that's what's necessary. But I want to at least uphold as a equal calling for people to consider is, am I called to be the glue person that actually helps sustain an institution through a transition? And I'm inspired by this by actually my wife. So she's the COO of a really leading innovative philanthropy organization in Silicon Valley. And she really sees her own calling as the right-hand person of the leader. And she has actually weathered through, I think, three executive director transitions in the organization over the last decade or so. And And people in her organization view her as the through line, as the glue that sort of kept that organization, kept the organizational culture and been the steward of that organizational culture through all these different executive transitions, which has otherwise been the occasion for a lot of staff turnover. And so I guess I want to ask you about that, Michael. Like, what is the, how do people discern when an institution is going through a transition? How do you discern, maybe I'm called to be that glue person in that moment?
Well, I mean, I'm assuming that listeners of Good Faith are folks who are actually trying to embody good faith in their lives and in their work experience. And so each of us have to be attentive to the leading of God. And you're right that hinge moments that come to institutions or to leaders can have this, you know, cascading effect to where it affects lots of other people. So, you know, that can happen. But I think our basic approach, our basic hermeneutic when we are in our work is that we're there until God unsettles us. And we need to approach the call to stability and to continuity. I think we have to approach that with almost sort of a godlike assignment. So the person who really shaped my thinking on this is Eugene Peterson, who's wonderful short little exegesis of the book of Jonah, a long obedience in the same direction, where he's basically saying, how is it that God is calling us to certain actions and certain behaviors? And occasionally we are called to flee, but most of the time we are called to stay. And so it is that sense of, there's Catholic orders that take a vow of stability and security and permanence, and a sense that I'm going to be here for the rest of my life. And I'd say, we Protestants don't always have that same kind of understanding. We're more like consumers, when in fact, I think that a large part of Christian faithfulness does entail that sense of stability and of being willing to stick it out for the long haul. And there's lots of examples of folks, but one person that I interviewed who I'd say really spoke to me about that was Condi Rice. So she was exceptional in that she served for an entire 8 years in the Bush White House, 4 years as National Security Advisor, 4 years as Secretary of State. And that kind of stability does not happen in many roles. And for her, part of that was a sense of loyalty and commitment to a president that she had worked with, that she trusted, that she believed in. But also, there was a stick-to-itness that she herself made a commitment that I'm going to see this through. And I think that there's something to be said for that, that we say, you know what, I'm going to stay here. And so you don't have to be the leader to make that decision. You can make that decision when you're the junior staffer, because that's part of what it is of a Christian calling, and particularly a calling to be able to serve and bless the institutions that the Lord calls us to.
I'm going to give a rant / question. Okay, so, and this is a common thing. We have a
rant alert.
Yes, we have a great guest, and they trigger a rant. So here's my rant. This is some there. When we're speaking of hinge moments and leaders, you're really reminding me how much some of your previous work has impacted me on the power of leadership and why leaders really matter, and how much institutions can often take on the character of their leaders, and the people within the institution can take on the character of their leaders. I have a great example from my time in Iraq, where our commander, we were a armored cavalry squadron in the middle of nowhere in Diyala province, Iraq. We were really disconnected from sort of our larger regiment. We were really disconnected from MND North, Multinational Division North, which was our larger unit structure. So our squadron commander had this kind of what I would call a fiefdom. He was the absolute lord ruler of our base, and by extension, the entire area of operations under his responsibility. And he had he's one of the better leaders I've ever known. And he was the perfect leader for the situation, in that we faced extreme violence, extreme hardship, extreme loss. And he really maintained, number one, he was physically courageous. Number two, he was extremely intolerant of incompetence or dishonesty. Number three, he was unshaken by events. So in other words, the response to even some of the most dramatic events was not any sort of panic, not any sort of alarm, what I would call sort of grim determination. And he was also a North Georgia guy from rural Georgia, and he had a very distinctive sort of Southern slower way of speaking. And it so infected and influenced the entire unit that I remember meeting this one of the troop commanders. And there's this funny moment. It seemed like everyone was from the South, you know, that in our unit. The unit came from Fort Hood, Texas. And I remember walking up, and when I first was get to know, this is in that early stage where you can ask questions, getting to know one of the troop commanders. And he spoke with a drawl. He had a dip cup, like everybody had a dip cup, like our commander had a dip cup. And he, I was like, Rob, where are you from? Are you from Dallas? Are you from Fort Worth? Are you from Killeen, Texas? This is where. And he looks at me and he kind of spits into the cup and he goes, Minnesota. And the culture that had been created had so influenced that it was even changing the manner of speech of people within the unit, which I found hilarious. But I ended up like kind of conforming to in all respects except the dip cup. And, you know, I've seen this in institution after institution where people take on the character of their leaders. And I'm not going to ask you to comment on this institution, but, you know, one of the opposites of facing chaotic or adverse experiences with sort of determination and calm is like the Trump administration, which would face chaos or adversity by freaking out and getting really angry, which has since become kind of the culture of the GOP. Whatever the issue is, we are going to freak out about it and get really angry. And I think that this is one of the things that I think that is a challenge right now is to re-educate people about the power of leadership and about the moral power of leadership. This used to be intuitive to us. But in many ways, because of recent political events, we've tried to say, no. For larger, better reasons, we can elevate somebody we wouldn't ordinarily hire to manage a McDonald's to like run a whole country. And we can insulate ourselves from all of that negativity. So I'm not going to put you into the fire of politics. But if you could reflect a bit on the cultural moral power of leadership as opposed to just the policy power of leadership and how you approach that as in running a university, because you set policy for certain, but that's only a part of what you're doing as a president of a university. So if you could talk about how you're what you think of when you're trying to establish a moral and cultural tone in an institution.
I think that your actions and your behavior, particularly when you're under pressure, become the boundaries for behavior for everybody else. So whatever the leader does sets the parameters, and in that box, then other people will follow. And so certainly the President of the United States sets that agenda, not just for their White House, but really for the rest of the country, of the kind of language you use, the kind of response you have, and especially how you respond to adversity or difficulty. I think that that is a key part of it. I also think how you respond to shocking or surprising news becomes an important way in which the norms sort of get repeated. And in many ways, it's like the leader's action doesn't just have a ripple effect, it has an accelerating effect so that more and more people copy or mimic what you do, because they also are shocked or surprised. And so it's why it's so important to remember simple advice: no sudden moves. You don't make any major changes. And this doesn't just apply, you know, to a workplace environment. It applies to our regular lives. So, you know, we have so many students who end up getting married, and then they have, you know, kids, they're starting their lives, and we stay in touch with them while after they've graduated. So they're in their 20s or early 30s. And one of my bits of advice that I give to all of those couples who are having their first child, you're going to be the most sleep deprived that you have ever been in your life. And so no major decisions for 3 months. Do not change your hair. Do not repaint your house. Do not decide to move. None of those things, because you're not thinking straight. And I think that part of it is just helping people to understand how you grapple with change, particularly shocking change. And that then has an effect across the whole organization or institution. It's the mature leader who recognizes that and says, you know what? I lose the ability to raise my voice when I take the leadership role. I can no longer really tell people exactly what I think. I might be able to tell some close friends, but I can't tell the whole organization. When I interviewed Drew Faust, the president of Harvard, she said, I learned that I really don't have the ability to think out loud in a group setting when I'm the president of Harvard, because my brainstorming session for other people becomes like, these are the marching orders, when in fact, I'm just thinking about possibilities. I think those realities, that's part of the burden of leading. And I think it's also the opportunity. You get the chance to shape people's behavior by just the way you react to news. And so it's the mature Christ follower who I think tries to take advantage of that and to use it for better good.
I want to add actually one other sort of move a leader can make that I think, especially a Christian leader can make, regardless of what institution they're a part of, including a part of a secular institution, that I find does not get used enough, which is the move and practice of confession. That when a leader confesses their own failing, that is actually a powerful norm-setting move that you make in the institution when the leader, him or herself, says, hey, this is our group norm, I violated it, and I'm sorry, and I'm going to make steps to correct it. I just had this experience of this in a very small way. I lead a leadership cohort development program that, because of the pandemic, we've been meeting mostly on Zoom, and we've been sort of setting it as a norm that you're really showing up and you are fully attentive. So no multitasking during our cohort day, our retreat day. And that's, we underline it, says show up for each other, you know, and be present and so forth. Well, recently I had a day that was really busy. I'll hide a lot of incoming stuff. And I just sort of decided to make an exception for myself. And I was doing some multitasking, and my co-leader spotted it. She was just honest. She saw, I could just tell. I know you enough to know when you're not sort of fully locked in. I can tell by your eye movement. I can tell by how attentive you are to others. She confronted this to me offline, right? She confronted this to me offline, and I felt deeply convicted by it. And we ended up going back to the group, and I confessed that I violated this group. I mean, they didn't need to know. I could have gotten away with it, but I had a partner who was brave enough, who loved me enough to confront me. And that was a very powerful moment for our group. And people talked about that in our surveys at the end of the group. Like, that was really important. That underlined for me how important this group is, that the leader was willing to admit when he, in my case, violated it. So Michael, I just wondered, have you seen good examples of leaders setting norms precisely through their failure and the way they handled that failure?
Yeah. It was, the great thing about being a college president a second time is that hopefully you don't make exactly the same mistakes you did the first time. And a few years ago, when I was serving at Gordon, I had Brad Rex, who was the CEO of Epcot, come and speak to a group. And he's talked about examples of how moments of forgiveness and repentance become really important crucibles for your leadership to either grow or diminish. And he said, there are three phrases that every leader has to master, and they are, I am sorry, I was wrong, please forgive me. And he said, you have to be able to say all three of those things when it comes to your attention that you didn't do something right, or And part of it is, you know, the difference between our intentions versus our impact. Oftentimes we intend good things, but the impact of our actions may be completely divorced from what we actually intended to have happen. And so a lot of times a leader has to apologize or ask for forgiveness, not for their intentions, which may have been good and noble, but instead for the impact of their actions or of their decisions. So, you know, there was an interaction I had with one of the vice presidents at my institution where I made a judgment call. And in the end, it was very unhelpful for a group of people. And I had Brad Rex speaking in my head saying, "Michael, it's time for you to say, I am sorry, I was wrong, please forgive me." So I did in that particular moment. And I hope that I do it more regularly, because I think that that does become a way in which a leader increases the trust and confidence of the people on their team.
Well, this has been great, not just the content, but to catch up, because Curtis is not your only friend on this podcast.
How do you guys know each other again? What's the connection?
David French is my hero, because when I faced, we met years ago through a mutual friend, John Kingston, from I think maybe Harvard Law connections. But David was an incredible friend and support when I was facing an institutional hinge moment when I was serving as the president of Gordon. And Gordon was singled out by a group of LGBTQ activists that wanted to bring change to our institutional stance on a traditional sexual ethic. And I needed a friend who could help me out. And David proved to be an extraordinary friend and support and encouragement to me, which I very much appreciate. And forever, I am grateful for David. And we're cheering you on, David, as you take on this additional role. We look forward to wisdom coming out of the pages of the New York Times through your column.
Well, I didn't raise that to get all that praise, but I'll take it. I appreciate it. And, you know, through that entire process, which involved even a more than veiled attack on the accreditation of the college, which was a very, very serious matter. And interestingly enough, that kind of attack really hasn't resurfaced since.
No, in fact, the legislation that President Biden just signed around same-sex marriage, they specifically have a reference that institutions' accreditation cannot be put at risk because of, you know, the earnest and faithful commitments that people have based on theology or philosophy around a sexual ethic. So we went through a difficult season, but I'm hoping that we created a space for faithful institutions to engage in a pluralistic world more effectively in the days ahead.
Michael, thank you so much for coming on and being our friend, as well as our expert on hinge moments. And this has been a hinge moment for the Good Faith podcast. This is the end of the old Good Faith, and we're about to enter a period of the new Good Faith. With some things carrying forward, David French will still be a regular presence on the Good Faith, but we're going to be bringing you some additional voices going forward. The good news is we're continuing. The other good news is you don't need to do anything to keep it coming. You can still download our episodes on the same platforms, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever. And we're going to be, because we are transitioning the podcast into Redeeming Babel, my team at Redeeming Babel is cooking up all sorts of new ways to engage you, our listeners, and bring us together as we, as friends, make sense of this world together. So thank you for being part of it, and God bless.